My name is Stephen. I'm the pastor here at Grace Church Norton. And if you've ever struggled to believe whether or not Jesus rose from the dead or not, I want you to know you're in good company. See, for the early followers of Jesus, Jesus made a number of things clear, but one of the things he made really clear and repeated over and over to them was this idea that he was going to rise from the dead. In Matthew chapter 16, it says, "From then on, Jesus began to tell his disciples plainly that it was necessary for him to go to Jerusalem, and that he would suffer many terrible things at the hands of the elders, the leading priests, and the teachers of religious law. He would be killed, but on the third day, he would be raised from the dead." Then the next chapter, it says, "After they gathered again in Galilee, Jesus told them, 'The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of his enemies. He will be killed, but on the third day, he will be raised from the dead.' And the disciples were filled with grief." I'm assuming that was for the killed part, not the raised from the dead part. Like, oh, he's back, right? But then Mark 8 says, "Then Jesus began to tell them that the Son of Man must suffer many terrible things and be rejected by the elders, the leading priests, and the teachers of religious law. He would be killed, but 3 days later, he would raise from the dead." See, despite making this clear over and over and over again, like these are just three different passages, but there's a number of them, despite teaching on this and reminding his disciples, like, hey, this is going to happen, but I will be back. I will rise from the dead. The days after Jesus was killed weren't spent by the disciples in like this eager anticipation. They were actually disheartened. They were scattered. They were seemingly in shock. See, even though Jesus told them about his resurrection, for them, they had seen now their teacher, their leader, and for the most devout followers of his, their God, brutally beaten and placed on a cross, nailed to a cross, and killed. Like, even if you had spent 3 years with Jesus during his public ministry, you had seen him go through all sorts of different things. You'd seen him perform miracles. He's done all this teaching. You have even, like, been a part of his ministry. You've broken bread with Jesus. You've been with him all this time. At this point, like, you might trust with everything you have in him, but up until this point, nobody had come back from the dead. And so for them, they had doubts. They were worried. And so just after his death is where I want to pick up the Easter story. We're going to be checking out the book of Luke. And just so you know, for those of you who might not know, the book of Luke is just one of four different accounts of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. The New Testament starts off with these four books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They each tell the story of Jesus' life and his death and his ministry, his resurrection. And so Matthew, Mark, and John each write about Jesus's their experience with Jesus from their perspective. But Luke does something a little bit different. And Luke actually writes his gospel account by not just using his own experiences with Jesus, because Luke was actually not in the closest circle with Matthew, Mark, and John. He was actually outside of that circle. So he doesn't just use his only experiences, what he heard Jesus say and what he saw Jesus do. Actually, what he does is he interviews several different people who also experienced Jesus' life. And so he gathers all this information, and what we learn by reading the very beginning of Luke's account is that he wasn't just writing to people who already believed. He's actually writing to one person named Theophilus. Scholars believe that Theophilus was most likely a very highly educated Roman citizen. Theophilus was the name of usually highly educated Roman men, but it could also be used as like a surname, like professor, or like if you graduated Harvard, you're a Harvard fellow. And so Theophilus is the name of this really educated guy, and Luke says, "I'm writing to Theophilus to actually give him more trust and give him more confidence in the story that Luke was telling him about Jesus." So if you're on kind of like the edge of faith or just trying to figure out church, what I want you to know is that what we're reading from the book of Luke is for somebody like you. That I love that one of the gospel accounts of Jesus' life was written to somebody who's kind of on the edge of faith, just trying to figure this whole thing out. And so we're picking up right after Jesus had just been killed. And so in Luke chapter 23, it says this: "Now there was a good and righteous man named Joseph. He was a member of the Jewish high council, but he had not agreed with the decision and actions of the other religious leaders, that decision being to put Jesus to death. Just like Jesus had said, it would be the religious leaders, the elders, and the high priests. He was from the town of Arimathea in Judea, and he was waiting for the kingdom of God to come. He went to Pilate, Pilate, who was the Roman governor over Jerusalem. See, the Roman Empire had taken over all of Israel, and they used Jerusalem kind of as a hub because Jerusalem had been this cultural and religious and even commercial center for all of Israel. So they had this hub there, and a lot of their power point was there. And so Pilate was the governor there. This guy, Joseph of Arimathea, requests Jesus' body. It says he asked for Jesus' body, and then he took the body down from the cross and wrapped it in a long sheet of linen cloth and laid it in a new tomb that had been carved out of rock. This was done late on Friday afternoon, the day of preparation, as the Sabbath was about to begin. Now, this was a unique situation too, because criminals who were put to death on a cross, they're crucified. They weren't like the... You wouldn't be crucified for a petty crime. You were crucified because of something that was serious. You were guilty of something atrocious, or you were a repeat offender of something that was awful. And so oftentimes what would happen to the bodies of these crucified criminals is they would just be discarded, because the family of that person who was crucified wouldn't want anything to do with them, because they wouldn't want to be associated with that person. Oftentimes that person was like, it was like they were dead to the family. Or any friends of that person, they wouldn't want to be associated with them, because now, like, what if I'm viewed as an accomplice, or like I agreed with this person? And so even the crowds that would show up to a crucifixion, they weren't there to like see the last moments of a loved one. Usually they were there to mock the criminal, because maybe they were family members of somebody who's a victim of that person's crimes. And so the bodies were usually thrown out in the dump, and they're going to be burned with the rest of the trash. The only reason why Jesus' body wasn't brought to the dump is because this religious leader named Joseph of Arimathea had enough political pull to request the body. And Pilate, who was the governor, had actually said when Jesus was on trial that he found no fault with Jesus. Like, he said that he's guilty of no crime. I don't want to put him to death, but the people were crying for Jesus to be killed. And so Pilate felt this kind of guilt over Jesus' death. And so he says, sure, you can take the body. And so then we see a couple of other people get involved in this story in verse 55. As Jesus' body was taken away, the women from Galilee being the primary area where Jesus did most of his ministry, followed and saw the tomb where his body was placed. And they went home and prepared spices and ointments to anoint his body. But by the time they were finished, the Sabbath had begun. So they rested as required by the law. So these women follow after Joseph carrying Jesus' body to see where Joseph puts the body. Now, just so you know, that the women weren't going to follow him so that they could follow up with this and make sure that they were there at the moment that Jesus rose from the dead. They actually went there because they were hoping to be able to care for the body, like dress it. And the same way that we have different customs and different cultures for caring for a deceased like family member or somebody that we honor, like we don't usually think of it that often because it's not normally like a topic of conversation, right? That would be a weird, like, hey, how do you want to be cared for when we don't do that, right? But like we have our own customs for that too. Like, you'll dress somebody in the finest clothes. We'll even put like makeup on the body so they seem more lively. And so, like, we'll even cross their arms. Even if the guy's never worn a suit in his life, you're going to dress him like he's going to prom, right? But so we'll do different things like that. And so for these ladies, they're hoping to care for the body, to honor Jesus's body. It wasn't a goal of theirs to, like, see him rise from the dead. They weren't expecting that. Maybe it passed through their mind on the day he was crucified or the next day, but they weren't thinking of that. And so they ended up going back home and preparing some spices, some linen, some ointment, all this stuff to really give Jesus like this proper burial. No one was expecting Jesus to rise from the dead in this moment. And the reason the women returned to the tomb was because they wanted to care for that body. So they're lugging all these spices, all these ointments, all these linen, all the way to the tomb. And then they find out that the body's gone, the tomb's rolled away. And like at that point, I'd almost be frustrated. Like, Jesus, I left you here. You couldn't stay here for like 3 days? Oh yeah, that's what you said you'd do, right? Now, I don't know where everybody's at in the room spiritually. And I don't know what challenges life might have thrown at you. But I do know that all of us would love to experience a breakthrough. Like all of us, whether it's you that would love to experience a breakthrough through something that has been a challenge in your life for years, or maybe you have a family member or a friend who's been dealing with something and you'd love to be the person that could help them out and help them overcome that thing that's been weighing on their life, weighing over them for a long time, for maybe as long as you've known them. We want to experience breakthroughs. What I love in this passage is that these ladies represent a beautiful picture of what it looks like to step out of a life valley, a life challenge, to be able to walk from a crushing defeat into an incredible victory. And so what I want to just do this morning is I just simply want to show you a few things that they do to maybe help you step away from a place that's been just this struggle, this low point. Like you can't even imagine moving on from this low chapter in your life to be able to find something new, to find some hope. And so in Luke chapter 24, verse 1, it says, "But very early on Sunday morning, the women went to the tomb, taking spices they had prepared. They found that the stone had been rolled away from the entrance, so they went in. But they didn't find the body of the Lord Jesus as they stood there puzzled. Two men suddenly appeared to them, clothed in dazzling robes." And these guys were angels. See, the ladies didn't have the right expectation. They weren't looking for the body to be gone. And they didn't know exactly what to expect when they got to the tomb. But what I love is that they were the first ones to see that Jesus had risen from the dead because they had chosen to seek Jesus. I think it's funny looking back at different historical events or scientific achievements or even sports championships, that when you look back, like the farther away we get from events, usually the more it seems like they were destined to happen. Like, oh, that was like part of the plan. Like that makes sense that that happened on that date, right? But then when we take a close look, oftentimes the reason why even the greatest things in history have happened, oftentimes they involved a lot less planning than we'd expect. Like even just a few of the great inventions or great things that have happened in history. In 1945, there's a man named Percy Spencer, and he was working on a microwave emitting magnetron, and he had a chocolate bar in his pocket. And as he was working on this magnetron, the chocolate bar melted, and he realized what happened, and a little bit later, he put in a patent for what we now call the microwave. Now, like, this is a really smart dude working on stuff that, like, I can barely pronounce microwave emitting magnetron. Like, try saying that a bunch of times. You can't. But, like, also, this dude's a snacker. Who puts a chocolate bar in your pocket while you're at... But so, like, he's working on this thing, and he realizes, like, oh, crap, like, my chocolate bar melted. First of all, I got to get new pants, but how am I going to pay for that? I'm going to invent the microwave. But, like, complete accident. In 1928... Sir Alexander Fleming accidentally left a culture of nasal germs. That dude picks his nose. That's what that means. But so he left a culture of nasal germs out on a countertop for 2 weeks. That's not a purposeful experiment. Like he forgot he left that out. He came back and he found that the culture, the germs, did not spread because there was a particular type of mold that had grown on the culture called penicillium, and he became the founder, the father of penicillin. Like, that wasn't a planned thing. That's accidental. 1945, there was a naval engineer by the name of Richard James, and he was working on developing these really soft springs to stabilize naval equipment, like really sensitive equipment on ships. One of the springs fell off a shelf in his office because he's on a ship, and it hit the floor and it started bouncing and kept on bouncing and kept on bouncing. He called his wife and he said, "I think I invented a toy by accident." And she named it the Slinky, and they're millionaires. See, the crazy thing is some of the most common things we use or some of even the greatest achievements are done like kind of by accident, but these guys, what I want you to pay attention to and what I want you to take away from that isn't like, I got to stop trying everything and wait for luck to hit me. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that each one of these people was looking for a solution to a problem. They were looking, they were seeking something, and they found an unexpected breakthrough along the way. And I think the same thing happens spiritually. That I truly believe that Jesus is the source of all hope, of life, of truth, of joy, of peace, of acceptance, of love, of all those things that the human soul seeks and desires. And what I challenge you to do if you're in the middle of one of these valleys is stop looking for a solution outside of Jesus. Look for him as the solution, seek him, and you might just find a breakthrough in one of the other areas or one of the challenges that you've been facing. That as we seek Jesus, we'll find that he is the true solution. These women, the wind had been taken out of their sails just a few days earlier after seeing Jesus killed in front of them. But these women were also the first ones to see that Jesus had risen from the dead because they chose to be closest to the tomb. They chose to seek where they last knew Jesus was. And maybe the reason you've struggled to believe in Jesus or believe that Jesus could be that solution is because you haven't taken the time to really seek him or spend time with him long enough to realize just what he could do in your life. Just what good he could do in the situation that you'd call nothing but bad. That this Jesus actually can be that solution. In Mark's account, he gives us another perspective of the ladies who are approaching the tomb. In Mark chapter 16, verse 3, it says, "On the way, they were asking each other, 'Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?'" Which is kind of crazy. Like, the ladies are approaching the tomb, they know where they're going, they know there's a giant stone, and they just go, "So how are we going to move it?" Like, they're planning on going to Jesus' body. They have no idea how it's going to move. But the truth is, this is where most of us stop. Like, this is where most of us, like, maybe you're trying to figure out God, Jesus, this whole church thing. By the way, I'm so glad that you're here. But there's also some stones, some obstacles in the way. Like, maybe for you, it's kind of like your own doubts or your fears. Or maybe you're worried that, what if my family or my friends finds out I'm going to church and now I'm one of those weird churchy people? I'm a pastor. They are weird. Or maybe you're worried about what the church people would think of you being new. Like, I bet those church people, they've spent their entire life in church. They got indoctrinated as toddlers, and they've never left that building. And I'll come in as an adult. I'm new. Like, that's weird. We all have those obstacles. We all have those little fears. But what I want you to see is actually the next verse. I love this. It says, "But as they arrived, they looked up and saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled aside." See, we all have an obstacle or five obstacles, however many obstacles that we use as justifications for why I shouldn't seek Jesus. It's not even worth my time. Like, it's not real. I met a Christian. They were really annoying or they were really rude. So, like, I don't want to be them. And it's like, Jesus doesn't want you to be them. Jesus wants you to look more like him. But what I love in this story is that these ladies continued approaching the tomb, not because they felt like they could move the obstacle on their own, but because they were willing to believe that God was bigger than the stone, that God could move the stone, but not only that, that God wanted to move the stone. And maybe the difference between finding God or not is believing actually that he wants to be found. In Jeremiah 29, verse 13, it says, "If you look for me wholeheartedly, you'll find me." See, if you seek Jesus, the Jesus who rolled away the stone, if you seek God, the God who wants to be found, I truly believe that you will find him. But once you do, as you seek him, the challenge then is actually to trust Jesus. Chapter 24, verse 5, story continues and it says, "The women were terrified and they bowed with their faces to the ground. Then the men asked," and I love this, "Why are you looking among the dead for someone who is alive? He isn't here. He's risen from the dead. Remember what he told you back in Galilee, that the Son of Man must be betrayed into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and then he would rise again on the third day." Like, he just literally says what Jesus had been telling them the whole time. He goes, "Did you not listen? Like, you thought he was God and he repeated something? Like, write that down, please." We see later on this chapter who exactly the women were. And it's there's a number of these women, but the only ones who are named in the book of Luke are this lady named Mary Magdalene, this lady named Joanna, and this lady named Mary, who is the mother of James. James, not the one who wrote the book of James, but James, one of Jesus's early followers. And I want you to know that none of them had what anybody would call like a perfect spiritual resume. Like, they weren't perfect people who Jesus just picked up and he was just like, "Yeah, you're good enough to follow me." That's not how this worked. In fact, Mary Magdalene is introduced in the story as somebody who had been possessed by 7 demons and had them cast out of her. I don't know what you have to do to have 7 demons in you, but like if you get 1, like I'd start reconsidering like my life choices, right? She had 7. So she has 7 demons cast out of her. And then Joanna, we find out later, is the wife of this guy named Chuza. Chuza was an advisor to many of the Roman leaders. So he's like a coach, a mentor to the very people who are oppressing the Jewish people. Jesus was born as a Jewish person. Like this, and she's just enjoying the status and the level of applause and acceptance that she's getting. Mary, James's mom, she's a lady who had so much attitude problems that she ends up telling Jesus that she wants her sons to sit next to Jesus in heaven. Like she's telling God what the seating arrangement is in heaven. So Jesus has to correct her. Like none of these people were perfect by any means. Each one of them had their own things going on. None of them had perfect track records, but each of them had something in their past that if any of us were picking who would choose, who would be able to see Jesus rise from the dead first, who would be the first to know that each of them had something in their life that would give us pause. Like, I don't know about that person being first in line to find out. But luckily for all of us, God doesn't write anybody off. See, they each had a past, but they also each had a moment in their life where Jesus challenged them and called them out on this idea that the things that they were chasing were just as empty as the tomb was going to be. See, Mary was chasing after comfort, wealth, and belonging in uncomfortable places. Joanna was a socialite who was enjoying relationships with all these high ups, but lacked a relationship with God. And Mary, the mother of James, was pushing her sons to greatness while not actually choosing to make a difference for anybody using her own life. See, I think this is why the words of these angels are so important and so powerful. They simply say to these women, "Why are you looking among the dead for someone who is alive?" It echoed Jesus' calling on their lives to stop seeking after life in dead places. And how many of us do the same? That we seek after life, after joy, after hope, after meaning, after purpose, and things that are just empty. And money, and the next achievement, and the next thing I can get, the next thing I can buy, and relationships that we know we don't belong in our job, our career. We seek after the life that only Jesus can provide. It's the same challenge this angel gave to them as the same challenge that Jesus gives to everybody. Stop seeking after life in dead places. Trust that I'm the provider of all the things, the only things that can really truly fulfill you. See, Jesus had promised that he'd rise from the dead, but not only did he make good on his promise of resurrection, his resurrection through him, we actually can find that he can bring to life the dead places of our lives. Jesus rising from the grave is an invitation to anybody who follows him to stop looking for life in those dead places, and trusting in Jesus is more. It's about more than just seeking a good feeling. It's about finding new life. Jesus said in John chapter 10 and verse 10, "The thief's purpose is to steal, kill, and destroy. My purpose is to give them a rich and satisfying life." And what Jesus is saying there simply is that there's a way of doing life where you're constantly pursuing peace, but on your way to peace, you keep on running low on the amount of peace in your life. You're seeking after hope, but on your journey to hope, you keep on running low to empty on your hope tank. Like, there's a way of doing life that only leads to hurt, to pain, to heartbreak. It's like driving a car where like all the tires are leaking. You can still drive the car, but you're gonna keep on having to spend time and spend money at all these gas stations trying to fill up the air pressure, trying to make sure everything's even, trying to make sure they're all good. It's gonna drive you crazy. Like, you're gonna get worn out. You're gonna get tired of wasting so much time, so much money just filling up these tires. And Jesus is saying, stop chasing that type of life. I don't just want to fill up the tires. I want to give you brand new tires and then put you on a whole different road. That Jesus wants us to step away from a life that leads to destruction, and he's calling us to a different type of life, a rich and satisfying one that only comes from trusting him. In Romans chapter 6 and verse 4, it puts this perfectly. It says, "For we died and were buried with Christ by baptism,
And just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glorious power of the Father, now we also may live new lives. See, all of the followers of Jesus were disheartened, they were discouraged, they were disappointed. But it was all because they had either forgotten what Jesus had said about his resurrection, or they just hadn't taken it seriously. And I think for any of us who have found ourselves in a life valley, in one of those challenging places, in a struggle place that we keep on feeling like we're beating our head against the same wall, I just gotta ask you, what words of Jesus have you forgotten? Or what promise of God have you just not taken seriously? Like, do I really trust what God has to say in this area of my life that I've been struggling in? Or do I really trust Jesus enough to give him the reins, to give him the steering wheel on my life and believe that he can actually, he's better at leading my life than even I am? See, I ask that question because of what happens next in the story. In Luke chapter 24, verse 8, it says, then they remembered that Jesus had said this, that he'd rise from the dead. So they rushed back from the tomb to tell his 11 disciples and everyone else what had happened. See, once they remembered Jesus' words, it energized them and it moved them. And I love this because up until this point in the story, everything in the story was moving so slow. Like Joseph requests Pilate to let him take the body down. And they have to lug Jesus' body slowly to this tomb. The ladies slowly follow. They see from afar where Jesus is laid. And then they're in mourning, slowly walking back to the house, preparing while probably weeping all this stuff for Jesus' body, knowing like once we get back to that tomb, all that's awaiting for us is this heavy stone that we'll have to roll aside. And even if we move that stone, all that's waiting behind that stone is the body of our Savior. Everything's going slow. Everything's heavy. Everything's arduous. And then there's this beautiful moment where they remember what Jesus had said. That Jesus said that he'd rise from the dead. The body's gone. These angels show up. They go, what are you doing here? Don't you trust what Jesus said? And suddenly it clicks. And it says that they rush back. They run to the 11 disciples. That suddenly, remembering and trusting the words of Jesus energized them enough to move them fast. It shakes them out of their fog. It shakes them out of their mourning. It shakes them out of their negativity. It caused them to run out of the valley they were in and back to everybody else who was trapped in that same fog and struggle. See, the truth is, you can seek Jesus, and that's awesome. And then when you trust him, that's awesome. But once you've trusted him, it's not a message that's just for yourself, that they didn't just stop at seeking Jesus or trusting Jesus, that then it caused them to share Jesus. That if you're a follower of Jesus, your faith isn't just for you. That you should, the more mature you are in your faith, the more you should care about people who don't share your faith. And what I love about these women is that they didn't just hear the message that Jesus had risen from the dead and go, oh, that's just a beautiful statement. That makes me feel so much better about this situation. Let's go home and just talk about it. They didn't do that. They rushed to people who didn't know yet. See, they felt compelled to share what they knew, what they had experienced, because it overwhelmed them. And we do this with every area of our lives. Like if you see a great movie, you're gonna share it with somebody. If you listen to a great song, you're gonna share it with somebody. If you see a really funny meme, you're gonna share it with everybody. If you're a vegan, you should keep that to yourself, but you still say it to everybody, right? Like if there's something that you're really excited about or something that you think is really beneficial to you, you're gonna make sure everybody knows about it. But what I also wanna make sure that you see in this is that the women weren't motivated by the sense that we're gonna make everybody believe this. They weren't motivated by everybody's response or what the response was going to be. They were motivated by the reality of what they had seen Jesus do in the tomb and what they knew Jesus had done in their life. That's all they needed, which is good news because of what happens next. Verse 10, it was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, and Mary the mother of James and several other women who told the apostles what had happened. But the story sounded like nonsense to the men. So they didn't believe it, which is crazy because all they're doing is saying, you know how Jesus said this? He did it. And the men go, that don't make any sense. Like, that makes a lot of sense.
Verse 12. However, Peter jumped up and ran to the tomb to look. Stooping, he peered in and saw the empty linen wrappings. He went in again. He went home again, wondering what had happened. He didn't believe it in the moment. I don't think that this takes away the credibility of what the Bible says about Jesus rising from the dead. If I'm honest, I actually think it adds to it. See, the writers of the Bible weren't afraid to show the very real, very human response of the disciples to this miracle that had never happened before. Nobody had ever risen from the dead before. And maybe you're in here and you're thinking, well, yeah, I struggled to believe it because, like, why hasn't it happened again? Because that's the point. It only happened once because there was only one Son of God and there was only one payment for our sins. But there are a couple things that give me confidence about the reality of Jesus rising from the dead. See, first of all, there is a whole guard, Roman guard, around the tomb because they knew that Jesus had said that he would rise from the dead. His followers were talking about it. And so they were thinking, well, if Jesus dies, like, then he's buried in this tomb. We're going to protect the tomb so nobody tries to steal the body. And so then there's only one entrance to the tomb. Nobody tried to take the body away. And if the disciples really wanted to lie to everybody and say Jesus rose from the dead, they wouldn't have put his body in a tomb with one entrance that would be surrounded by a Roman guard. They would have let Jesus be buried in the trash in the dump and then steal the body later and go, we don't know what happened. And the other thing is that all the disciples agreed on this story and they were so fervent in their belief in this story that each one of them were willing to die for their faith. Like, I've lied before. But I've lied before, right? But I'm not willing to die for a lie, right? Like, that's a whole other level. And let alone have all these guys. Like, you can make a pact with people, but, like, then people get other priorities over time. These guys each were willing to lay their life on the line for their faith. They were saying, I'm willing to go down for this because I believe that this is so true. So each one of them stuck to their story, stuck to their faith. And then also, the fact that Christianity, the movement of Christianity grew faster when there was more eyewitnesses that could have disproven if it was false, the story of Jesus or that he rose from the dead. So the time when the most amount of people could have said that this isn't real at all, Jesus, the movement of Jesus moved faster and reached more people than ever before and ever since. Like, all those things give me more confidence in my faith that Jesus really did everything that he said he was going to do. But what's even crazier is these women, despite seeing all this and having the disciples not believe them, they didn't argue. They didn't fight it because they knew that the charge that the angels had given them was simply to share what they knew. It wasn't to try to make anybody believe. They were just told to let everybody know what they had seen, what they had experienced. But the disciples who sought Jesus, like Peter, and then didn't know what to do with what he found, struggled to trust Jesus, I want you to know that that wasn't the end of the story. In fact, in Luke 24, verse 35, this is what happens. Says, then two men from Emmaus told their story of how Jesus appeared to them as they were walking along the road and how they recognized him as he was breaking the bread. And just as they were telling about it, so they're meeting with the disciples, just as they were telling about it, Jesus himself was suddenly standing there among them. Peace be with you, he said. But the whole group was startled and frightened, thinking they were seeing a ghost. Why are you frightened, he asked. I'd be scared. Like, I can tell you a couple reasons, because you just showed up out of nowhere. Like, you didn't walk you walked through the wall and you came in here? I'm a little scared, right? Why are your hearts filled with doubt? Look at my hands. Look at my feet. You can see that it's really me. Like, Jesus wasn't afraid of eyewitnesses. Jesus wanted as many people as possible to see him. Touch me and make sure that I'm not a ghost, because ghosts don't have bodies as you see that I do.
So just so you know, according to Jesus, ghosts don't have bodies. I don't know when that will be applicable, but that's just like some information for you. As he spoke, he showed them his hands and feet. Still, they stood there in disbelief, filled with joy and wonder. And then he asked them, "Do you have anything to eat?" And they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he ate it as they watched. Like, this is such a weird interaction. But then it says, and then he said, "When I was with you before, I told you everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled." And then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures. And as he said, "Yes, it was written long ago that the Messiah would suffer and die and rise from the dead on the third day. It was also written that this message would be proclaimed and the authority of his name to all the nations, beginning in Jerusalem. There is forgiveness of sins for all who repent." Not just good people, not just rich people, not just educated people, not people who think that they're good enough, for all people. And then he says, "You are witnesses of all these things." Maybe you don't believe in God, or you've struggled to believe in the reality of Jesus. If that's the case, can I just challenge you to do one thing? It's to do the first thing I talked about. Just seek him. If he's not real, you won't find him. But I have enough confidence that God meant what he said when he said, "If you seek me wholeheartedly, you will find me." He wants to be found. If he's not real, you won't find him. But if he is, I don't know about you, but I'd want to find out. I believe if you genuinely look for God, he'll show himself. It's a quote from an author by the name of C.S. Lewis, and he simply said this: "Christianity, if false, is of no importance, and if true, is of infinite importance. The only thing it cannot be is moderately important." There are three steps to overcoming those valleys in life, those challenges. Whether you're a follower of Jesus or not, the journey doesn't end seeking Jesus. We still pursue him. We still look for him in every area of our lives. But maybe you don't know Jesus and you came here this morning because you are trying to figure this out. Can I just challenge you with your next step? And that's to trust him. That it's one thing to say, like, I've read things that Jesus has said. I'm taking his advice on certain areas. Like, I'll go to church. I'll apply the practical stuff. But the whole, like, God thing, not for me. Jesus is either Lord of all or not at all. That he's either the one steering the ship or he's not, and it's you taking the command of your life. But I do believe that Jesus is a far better God of our lives than we are. And this same Jesus wanted everybody, whether you consider yourself a churchy person, not a churchy person, if you consider yourself a good person, a bad person, if you're really proud of your life achievements, or you kind of walk in every room hoping that nobody asks about your past, that Jesus sees it all, but he loves everybody. And the best thing that he wants for you is for you to have a relationship with him, because he knows that all of those other areas, all those other things that we keep on seeking life after, life in, are dead. They're empty. So we go, stop finding hope in an empty place. Stop looking for hope in a dead place. I'm still alive. Seek me, trust me, you'll find me. And if you found me, it's time to share me. I want you to bow your head, close your eyes. God, I thank you for you. I thank you for what Easter is, what it represents. That this isn't just a religious holiday that should just pass by, that this is actually a moment to celebrate the reality that you really did everything that you said you were gonna do. That you weren't just some religious figure who went a little bit too far, got a little too extreme, and so they killed you and that was the end of the story. That you actually, Jesus, lived your entire life walking straight up to the people that everybody else avoided. You actually spent your life investing in the people that everybody else had written off. You spent your life teaching people how to love their neighbor. how to honor each other, how to treat one another with value. But you spent your life being God so that we'd have no question of what it would look like if God was really here, what his character is, does he care about me, do I matter, that all of the questions that we have about God himself can be answered through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. That you stepped out of eternity and into our reality so that we could know the reality of who you are. And so maybe you're in the room right now and you've been seeking Jesus, or maybe you had no intention of seeking Jesus and then a family member said, we go to church on Easter, there's no exceptions. And this morning you're going, dang, there's more reality to this than I thought. Can I just invite you to know exactly what Jesus did for you? That Jesus lived a perfect life as an example to us of what it would look like if somebody lived their entire life in connection with God. That he was guilty of no sin, but we are. And sin is disobedience to God and selfishness towards other people. We're all guilty of it, me included. But then he went to the cross for our sin. He wasn't guilty of any, but he still died unjustly on our behalf. But then he conquered the power of sin and death by rising from the dead. And that's what we're celebrating on Easter. Like today, we're celebrating the reality that whatever has brought you to this place in life, that maybe the habits or the poor choices that have been narrating your life don't have to be the lead narrator of your life anymore. That this God that the Bible calls the author and perfecter of our faith wants to write a new story, and he can start that today. So if you want a relationship with that Jesus, all I'm asking is that you pray in the quietness of this moment, Jesus, I'm all in. I'm all in. If you know Jesus, what are the areas of your life that you haven't been trusting him with? What are the words of Jesus that you've forgotten, or the promises of God that you haven't taken seriously? And if you know Jesus, I really believe it's your responsibility to share him. It's a beautiful reality that God included people like us. We're just people, broken, feeble, but God included us in what he called the ministry of reconciliation, the opportunity to help more people find and follow him. It's a huge honor, but it's also a responsibility. Don't let Easter be the only time that you invite somebody to church. Don't let Easter be the only reason you invite somebody to church. That if he really is the one who brings true hope, love, peace, joy, faith, then bring him in every room you enter. God, I thank you for you. I thank you for Easter. I thank you just for the reality that you really did everything you said you were going to do, and that the tomb is empty. Amen.